Mary Shebest is the author of a previous poetry collection, Granted, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. She teaches at Lewis and Clark College and lives in Portland, Oregon. Welcome, Mary, to Words on a Wire.
Mary, thank you for joining us on the show. I'd like to start off with just a general question about this fantastic book, which won the National Book Award, which is, you know, for those who are listening, no small thing. The judges said Incarnadine was a religious book for non-believers. How do you feel about that description?
Well, first, thank you so much for having me. And I love that description. I was so grateful for that description because it was very much the project I wanted to bring into the world. I wanted to use this religious iconography and carry it forward into secular meditation to try to make use of something that a secular world maybe had left behind and think, well, maybe it actually can still be useful even beyond the context of religion or belief.
One of the themes in the book is the Annunciation, when the angels appeared to Mary and, you know, basically told her what was going to happen. And a little funny fact, it didn't occur to me until last night, and I've been reading this book over and over for the last couple of weeks, but it didn't occur to me until last night that your name is Mary.
Yeah. Right.
But what is it about that theme, that the Annunciation, what is it about that fascinated you?
Well, I think I probably have a few answers to that. One does have to do with the fact that my name is Mary, and I grew up in a Catholic world, and I attended the Church of the Annunciation, and this was an image I spent a lot of time simply looking at. So it snagged my imagination really early on. I always felt like I had my identity was in some way in relation to this figure of Mary. But what really sort of opened it up for me was a trip to Italy where I was looking at these paintings in the museum. And out of all of these religious scenes, I loved the sense of encounter in the Annunciation. I loved, the kind of joy, in a sense, of the scene that, here was a human creature, a human girl, and here was an angel, a non-human creature, and they are actually in the same seen together, perceiving one another, communicating in some way, and even just that sense of possibility that there can be some interaction with something beyond us. I love that vision. But part of what I also found really moving looking at the paintings was the insistence by so many of the painters on the distance between these two figures, right, often mm-hmm. articulated with a lot of distance, a lot of objects between them, including columns. And that seemed to really honor the complication of what it might be to encounter someone truly not like you. It's not an easy communication. It's perhaps not a complete communication or understanding. There's always distance. And, the paintings I saw more and more as the subject in these paintings is actually the distance between the two figures. Mm. And I love that. I love thinking about that very energized space between them. And all the other religious icons really have a figure in the center rather than a space. And that's what I started thinking about, wanting to write into. What if my poems could occupy a similar space?
Could you explain to us the process for writing a poem? How does that come along?
Gosh, I think it's different every time. I'm a really slow writer, so poems come from a lot of different places. Sometimes I start with a bit of language. Sometimes I start with a concept or idea. Sometimes I start with an image or a voice. And I just try to be really patient and move it through drafts and try to push it into the most unexpected places that I didn't know I was going to go. You ask about form. And one of the things I like about form and sometimes being accountable to different forms is I think forms can lead us, and I think there can be wisdom in inherited forms, that they've stayed with us for a reason, that those structures push the imagination, channel the imagination in particular ways. And I always feel like my best hope as a poet is that the forms, if I lean on them, can lead me, that the poems can be smarter than I am, that I don't know where to go, but if I trust the lead of the form, then that can be a whole lot wiser than I am.
When you talk about form, are you referring to learning the forms as a poet? You learn the sonnet, you learn the sestina, you learn the vianelle. And if so, how important do you think that is to developing as a poet, to understand and to master those forms?
Yeah, those are part of what I'm definitely talking about. But, I also think that being accountable to any invented form can serve very similar ways in pushing you toward different things than your forms might have. You know, I feel like it was really important for me as a poet to become familiar with those inherited forms, but I would never presume to say that I think those particular forms are vital for every poet to know and learn. I think there are any number of routes.
Yeah. Well, it certainly couldn't hurt to learn the forms because I think when you begin to follow language or whatever impulse you follow into a poem, sometimes those forms kick in, even if it's just for a line or two.
That's right. I think that's right.
And it just gives you a larger toolbox, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite poem from this collection?
That is an interesting question. I don't think anyone's ever asked me that.
I do.
What's your favorite?
I love the On Wanting to Tell Blank About a Girl Eating Fish Eyes. That is a lovely poem. In fact, I just told you I just got back from Madrid.
Yeah.
I brought some graduate students there because they have a low residency option to our online MFA in creative writing. And I sent them the link on that poem because it appears on, I think, poetry.org.
Poetry, yeah.
And you even introduced the poem. But we read the poem in our workshop, and it's just an absolutely lovely poem.
One of my favorite poems from this collection is Girls Overheard While Assembling a Puzzle.
Mm-hmm.
I really like that one. I have two children. They're toddlers. And the conversations with them are very much like this poem. You say things like, are we supposed to believe she can suddenly talk angel? Or, I wish we could walk into that garden and pick an X-ray to float on. Or, I like the angels giving her a little piece of honeycomb to eat. I don't see why God doesn't just come down and kiss her himself. They're very playful, very imaginative, and I actually read the poem and didn't look at the title. It's a different meaning. I just started reading it. Sometimes I do that. I read a poem without reading the title. I thought it was so deep. I was like, what is this saying? And then I saw the title and it made complete sense. So I really like the way that you play with image, and it's so unexpected, like you said, with your process, that you don't know where it's going to take you. And I totally got that. Some of the images, they're kind of shocking at times, and they're so strong. And I really enjoyed so many of the poems.
Thank you. And I'm so pleased that you find that one convincing in terms of the voices sounding actually like girls, because I very much made it up. But that, you know, that's one where the abecedarian form, I really leaned on that to push me toward that variety of voices. I'm also really interested that you both chose poems centered around girl figures, which I was really interested in this book, because the figure of Mary, you know, is this sort of verge between, you know, being a girl and not, and what age was supposedly this figure, probably quite young.
Yeah.
And at the same time, the book is trying to work out, in some ways, a relationship to this iconic figure who has also been, I think, imaginatively really a hard figure for me to live with. This ideal of, you know, what does it mean to be an ideal female in this world? Here's this icon that is a mother and a virgin, and this is what we're told over and over that makes her sort of wonderful. So what does it mean to be a woman in the world who is neither? That, I think, is part of what I'm trying to work out in the book.
And that one is also summarized, what you just said, when on the poem Update on Mary.
Mm-hmm.
I think it really gives us a window into what you're thinking and how you feel about your name and how you feel about, you know, what you just said in your poem Update about Mary. One of the lines says, when people say Mary, Mary still thinks Holy Virgin, Holy Heavenly Mother, but Mary knows she is not any of those things.
Yeah.
and a lot of them, it's so relatable to me. Just these very random thoughts that pop into our heads at times. I feel like I know you through this poem, just getting an insight into what goes on inside of Mary's head. So that was also one of my favorite poems.
Oh, thank you. I mean, it's so gratifying to hear that you could relate to it. That was probably the poem that I really wondered about including in the book, because it felt so personal that I had doubts about including it. Thank you.
We're talking to Mary Shebus, author of Incarnadine, which won the National Book Award for Poetry. I wanted to ask you about the visual poem. You wrote an essay, I think it appeared on, was it poetry.org?
That was on Grey Wolf.
Grey Wolf, that's it. Wonderful press outside of Minneapolis, I believe. But you were talking about how the temporal nature of poetry, and I guess by that you mean that, you know, when we read a poem, it's just that we're in the moment, we're experiencing the poem, and that in many ways the visual poem, that is the poem that is striking immediately, even before reading it. In this case, you have a picture of the sun, where the lines kind of extend out as little rays of the sun, that it kind of disrupts the temporal nature of poetry. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
I can try. I mean, I find this a really tricky and endlessly fascinating subject, and certainly there are people who have much more to offer on it than I do.
Well, let me rephrase the question then. When we look at a visual poem, like I'm reminded of that poem that's shaped like a swan, or a poem that's shaped like a, you know, anything. In fact, I had a graduate student turn in a poem shaped like a bird, and it seemed more gimmick than it did organic. And it's really difficult to get away with a poem that is shaped by something. Yet, you did it twice in this book, at least. One with the little graph where you said was an outline based on a friend's teaching lessons, and then the other one with this poem, The Shape of the Sun. How do you get away from gimmick? How do you make that poem organic?
You know, I thought about this a lot because, you know, my own history is I used to just hate visual poems. I just, if I was teaching in a textbook about poetry, the chapter I always skipped in teaching was a chapter on visual poems because I always found them gimmicky, and I was always afraid, oh no, I'm going to get poems about baseball in the shape of a baseball. And so it wasn't something that I thought a lot about for a long time. You know, when I said that the poems deal with the temporal, it's just hooking into that idea that poems work with time, I think, that they have a beginning and they move through and have an ending in a way that's very different from a painting, which we take in all at once.
Right. And like music, poetry can't be summarized. You can't really summarize a poem. You have to be there.
Correct. That's right. But at the same time, and, you know, this might for me have something to do with thinking about how religious icons are used for meditation, which are, you know, primarily a visual history. And part of what I was trying to do in this collection is think about using these old icons for a more secular meditation. So it's probably not an accident that I started thinking about how visual things prompt meditation. And there certainly is a history of, you know, visual arrangements of words as meditative objects, not just pictorial images. So the thing I loved about the one that looks a little bit like a sunburst is that I really loved the idea that it is something you can take in all at once on one level. And then as you wish, you can sort of zoom in and out of it. And that was one where I really did begin with the form.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't say, here's an idea and here would be the great form for it. I really started thinking about what would be a poem that actually would suit this form. You know, I honestly don't know if I avoided the gimmicky through it.
I think you did, and I'll tell you why I think you did.
Yeah.
You don't compromise the line. And I think in a lot of visual poetry, the line is compromised for the image. But here, the lines, they go out, you know, like rays of the sun, but each line is complete. You know, each line,
yeah.
It's not like it's just an eye, you know, because
right.
of how you have to have the thin neck of the swan, for example.
Right.
And the other interesting thing about this, I see it kind of like that painting by Velázquez, Las Meninas, where you're standing in front of the painting and you're looking at it and you're not quite sure what is amiss, but then suddenly it occurs to you that you are part of the painting, that the painting does not exist without you, and that everybody's looking at you, and you see your image in the mirror, and you're the king and the queen, and you're part of the painting. And this poem, you're part of the poem. You have to turn the page. You have to turn the book around and around to read the lines. And you probably look silly to people if you're reading it in a buzz, because they, what is that, a centerfold? But you become part of the poem. And it really does have that meditative effect, I think, because you are actually interacting with it.
Yeah, thank you. You know, that was my dearest hope, to try to provoke that interaction. But, yeah, for me, I felt like the form, you know, and I had readers who said, this is too gimmicky, don't include it in the book. Mm-hmm. But for me, I ended up feeling like I did need it to be in that form, because every line is modifying that central subject, which is also posited as an absence by that form, and then every line can work as both a modifier and as a question about that missing or at least unseen central subject of God or not God.
And quite frankly, you know, had you included it as the first poem, it may not have worked as successfully. But by the time we get to that, you certainly have earned our trust. We're talking to Mary Shebus, author of Incarnadine. It's a book of poems, won the National Book Award. And Mary, we have this segment called Poem of the Week, where we and if we have a poet on the show, we ask the poet if they'd be willing to read one of their poems.
Sure, absolutely. I used to work night shifts at a group home for mentally disabled adults, and I loved the job, I loved the people, and, you know, the whole book is sort of centered around the idea of encounter, and especially the idea of encounter between creatures, people who have some sense of distance or difference between them. And have the possibility of perhaps changing one another. One of the things about the job is I was allowed to sleep during the night if everyone else was sleeping. And there was one woman who did not like to go to sleep, and so this is the poem that takes off from that. Night shifts at the group home for Lily May. The job was easy. I tucked them in, kicked off my shoes, listened for the floor to go quiet. Everyone slept except one. Outside her door, she paced, she hummed, holding the edge of her torn nightgown. Pointing, I told her, to bed, your bed, but she would not stay there. She was old, older than my mother, manic, caught up in gibberish, determined to sleep on my cot. At first, it was just to quiet her. I could only sleep if she slept, and I needed relief from myself. That is how she became a body next to mine, whether or not I wanted there to be a body. She climbed into my bed. I let her sleep hot and damp against my spine. All night she rocked, she turned, she poked her spastic elbows into my calves and slurred her broken noises in the dark. All the old fans went round in clicks those summer nights, and she rolled in bed and kicked me in the head, and I was happy. No words, no tricks. I just didn't love my loneliness. My mind felt cooler with her there. Beside her, I could have been anyone. She had no word for me, and not the kind of mind to keep one. And if she kicked me some nights, just for the fun of it, who was I to disappoint my one? Sometimes I imagine I was someone she won at a fair as the wheel spun under the floating, unfaltering sun and clicked each lucky one and one until I was happily undone.
Wow. That was Mary Shebitz reading from her book, Incarnadine. Thank you so much, Mary. I have to tell you, I'm teaching a graduate poetry workshop next semester, and I'm using this book.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for having me.